Okay. James chapter 1 verses 9 to 12. Who's willing to read?
I'll read that. I have the FBV version, which
Pre-Bible.
is what? Pre-Bible version. Okay.
Right? Believers who are born poor should take pride in the high position they've been given, while the rich should boast in the humble position they now have, since they will fade away like flowers in the field. For the sun rises along with a blistering wind and scorches the grass. The flowers fall and their beauty is marred. Everything the rich achieve will fade in just the same way. Happy is anyone who patiently endures temptation, for when they prove that they are trustworthy, they will receive the crown of life which God promises to those who love him.
What does it mean, brothers and sisters who are poor should find satisfaction in their high status? What is James talking about, their high status?
I think he's talking about the God perspective on being poor and needing to depend on God versus having riches and boasting about that. So I think it's a God take. It sure isn't our world's view of what's good or desirable most of the time. So I think it's a God perspective that challenges society's perspective.
Okay. So instead of maybe being in a privileged class, the poor who believe in God and trust in Him are in a loved class, a valued class.
It brought to
Well,
mind the that he who would be first among you must be the servant of all, and the parable about the first shall be last and the last shall be first.
exactly.
That God has an upside down hierarchy in his kingdom.
Yes.
Very much opposite what we think. And also the thing that Maxwell often repeated, that that the people of that time thought that if you were rich, you were blessed, and if you were blessed, you were good. So that poor people were obviously not blessed, and therefore were bad people. And Paul is just reinforcing the inversion of that whole idea in God's kingdom.
Right, and the verse that comes to mind, if the rich can't get into heaven, who can?
And
was going to say,
that really emphasizes the fact that they had this idea that the rich were automatically saved and the poor were cast out.
was going to say that 9 is coupled really with 10. The other side, it says, but the rich person's pride should be in his humiliation because he will pass away like a wildflower in the meadow. What it's saying, I think, is that a person whose value or their position is derived from their own self-evaluation, really what it's talking about, is not very high. I mean, we know that just from how we work with each other. We don't say, I have evaluated myself again today and I'm a 10, just so everybody knows. Everybody just laugh. We know that's silliness. And so I think that's what he's saying here. Your high status as a believer, as a truster in God, is very high because God evaluated it and said so. That's what I get from it.
another thing that occurs to me is that I need to remind myself that by those standards of that day, and even by the standards of this day, and even in the standards of the world, I belong in the rich category, not in the poor category. Anybody who has the technology to participate in this or even listen to this afterwards is rich by almost any measure. So this applies directly to me, I guess, is what I'm when I'm having to remind myself.
My brain is hearing a description of Jesus, one of the churches, of seven churches that you, who is rich, at Laodicea, I believe it is. If you're rich and have need of nothing, and you that need poor. Of nothing sounds like that pride. I'm secure. I don't need any healing. I don't need anything. I'm fine.
Yeah, I think that we can believe that being right or being self-righteous, which is what Laodicea is talking about. They're self they think they're righteous and good, and they don't have any need for anything. It's true. It talks about that in terms of riches, but it's obvious that they're talking about in terms of character. They think they're so right or righteous.
Mm-hmm.
What Jesus wants is not status, but relationship. That's what, mm-hmm. if you go to the end of that passage, and of course we're jumping ahead because eventually we'll get to Revelation 3. But if you go to the end of that passage, Jesus says, I'm outside. I'm outside the church. Standing at the door and knocking. If anyone hears my voice, I will come into that one, and they will, and I will eat with that one, and they will eat with me. That's what he wants. It's not status, but relationship.
Yes.
I've just got a couple of verses to share that brought to mind. So you're all familiar with Matthew 5. The first people that Jesus identifies is those who are poor. And here my version says, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Usually rich people aren't poor in spirit, right? We might tie it to earthly wealth, but poor in spirit, those who are poor in spirit, the kingdom of God is for them. And then coming over here to Paul, we have this other famous passage here in Colossians chapter 1, and just focusing on verse 27, to them God willed to make known what are the riches of the glory of this mystery among the Gentiles, which is Christ in you, the hope of glory. And so, you know, it's described as, you know, riches, this glory that we experience when we're in this deep, intimate relationship with Christ that can't match any earthly riches, but is something that is only really been revealed after Jesus' death and resurrection. And it's a beautiful gift that anyone can receive. So I think about this year, let the lowly brother glory in his exaltation. That comes about, as you said, Jean, through this intimate personal relationship with God that the individual can have. It lifts us up.
Let's I think we've kind of covered these verses quite nicely. Let's look at verse 12. Those who stand firm during testing are blessed. They are tried and true. They will receive the life God has promised to those who love him as their reward. This is in the same context as what is true status or what is true value. Is it possible that those who are tested, people who are tested are often losing things?
Poor.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if it can also be a way that God evaluates me and then turns around and gives me the results of the evaluation. I think of Abraham. When he was asked to go sacrifice his son, I don't think God put that in there just so that today I could read that story and see how God feels about me. I think I always think of these stories as, you know, back when they were written, having a very powerful, when he experienced it, a very powerful reason that God had for Abraham. And I believe that when that was done, when that event was completed, Abraham felt a value in God's eyes, I think, that he may not have felt before that. Certainly he had an experience and a relationship with God after that that he didn't have at that level before. So maybe it's a way that God helps us see that what he has done in our life to develop us into one of his a tight relationship with one as one of his children. And then we look at that, we observe out the other end, you know, it always looks easier when you look back than when you look forwarding on these testing kind of things. And we can see God really has moved me in a positive way. You know, maybe it's the best way to see God's measurement of us sometimes.
So I've long struggled with this concept of God testing us so he knows what's in us. Because it sounds like God doesn't know.
Well, that's what I was saying. Maybe he's doing it for me. Maybe he was doing it for Abraham. God didn't, he didn't have any doubts about Abraham. I don't believe that God would put Abraham through that and then have a catastrophic failure then and say, I knew that Abraham was no good anyway. You know, I don't think God works that way.
Well, you can say the same thing about Job, but it does seem to me that there's another reason. It isn't just for us. It is for the whole universe.
Mm. Exactly.
Because the way I see God running the universe is through an open court. Anybody can come to court and lay a claim against somebody else. And the way God determines the evidence is by testing, empirical testing, if you would.
I think maybe we need to read on to verse 13 and 14 and 15.
Okay, why don't you read those, Mark?
Okay, so I'm also reading from the Feet Bible version. Nobody should say when they're tempted, I'm being tempted by God, for God is not tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. Temptations come from our own evil desires that lead us astray and entrap us. Such desires lead to sin, and when sin is fully developed, it causes death.
Yeah, so God isn't the one who tests people, but he usually has somebody who wants them tested, as in Job. God commends Job to the Satan, but the Satan says, you give me a chance at him, and he'll curse you to your face. And so that testing happens not because God does it, but because Satan is all too happy to do it and insists on it. Now, the being tempted by oneself is also true.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We tend to test ourselves. We tend to tempt ourselves. But this has to do with our sin problem. It doesn't have to do with a trial before the court, like a regular testing, like what Job went through, or like Abraham went through. By the way, the rabbis, on the story of Abraham and the sacrifice of Isaac, the Jewish rabbis understand that, or have understood, I think it was medieval rabbis, understood now God tested Abraham as to be a similar situation as with Job. But instead of allowing for the Satan, the text has God doing the testing.
I really like that. I have never heard anybody back up because I've always thought, I just don't believe God would have done it that way. Yeah.
And it's very interesting.
It's encouraging to me to, hey, I'm not the only one who's thought that.
it's very interesting that you have God in the first part of the story, and then when you have the substitute, you have Yahweh's angel, the second part of the story.
Yeah, because you wonder how could God go against what he said.
So if this is a Job situation, it makes a lot more sense. But the problem is that Satan is a later development. There wasn't in the five books of Moses, there's no dualism. God is the author of everything.
Yeah.
And it's not until Job and First Chronicles and Zechariah that you have Satan. Those are the only three places that Satan is found as a person who does testing and argues against God in court and so on.
What was Zechariah? I mean both Job and Chronicles were probably post-exile. Did Zechariah fall into that as well?
Zechariah is clearly post-exile. Zechariah is one of the first to return from exile. Mm-hmm. So it's not exilic, it's post-exilic. I just think that helps us a little bit not to feel like God has any sadism in him.
Do you think that maybe sometimes we explain or want to explain as God testing me when all God is really doing is providing that freedom of choice, freedom of my expression or my walk away from the relationship with him. We turn that around and say, I think God was testing me or God was testing him or her. And a lot of times I think all it really is the freedom working its way out. God allowed us the freedom, and we turn around and impugn God with, oh, he's testing so-and-so, you know. May not be any action there at all on God's part other than to allow the freedom of life, you know.
I think that's true, and I find myself, even when I'm in a tough situation, I wonder why God is doing this to me, and I'll even ask him why he's doing it to me, and I know better. I know completely better. He's not doing it to me at all. But that you get that feeling when something bad is happening to you, that God is doing it to you. It's part of being in a sinful world and being too close to the sinful nature that we all have.
Which is so bizarre. Because who accuses the lifeguard of drowning them?
Yeah.
Exactly.
I remember when I was in nursing and we first started studying Kubler-Ross, you know, and one of the stages was being angry at God, you know, seeing him somehow causing this or bringing this about or not intervening, you know, from a Christian perspective. But, you know, I think that's one of the accusations that God somehow is behind the evil in the world that exists. Why doesn't he stop all the evil in the world, or why does he bring it on? So I appreciate what connections you're making. You know, this is Job reveals this is Satan and what he's up to.
Mm-hmm. Jean, just to clarify that point again, did you say, if I understood you right, on Abraham, the story of Abraham, that it's he thought it was God's voice, or what word is it that
the Jewish rabbis saw the testing of Abraham as like the testing of Job. And how far you want to take that, you know, but it would seem that someone accused God, and that's what they saw. They saw that Satan was accusing Abraham like he accused Job.
Yeah. And even got Abraham to believe it was God's voice.
Well, it was voice.
It's hard to know. I don't know quite how far to take it because I haven't. I got this knowledge secondhand. I haven't read the rabbis that say this, so I don't know how far they take it. But anyway, Satan's in the picture in their mind.
Yeah, makes sense. Yeah, there is a destroyer, father of all lies, murderer from the beginning.
It's ironic how often we I don't know if people actually think this, but we often say things that sounds like somebody used the lifeguard, that God drags us out into the surf and pulls us under so that he can rescue us. And to me, that says terrible things about God. I'm sure most people aren't taking it that way, but I can't help but think that, you know, well, if God really wanted to save me, he would have just kept me on the beach in the first place, you know. Anyway.
Isn't that why verse 15 is so important in our understanding about it's our internal evil desires yes. that lead to sin, and sin, when it's fully developed, causes sin. God isn't the one causing death. Sin causes death. What pulls me into sin is my own evil desires, and I'm affected by the evil desires of other people as well. That's part of the process.
Yeah, I like that verse.
So maybe that's one of the telltale signs that it's not God allowing me to go through an experience that he knows will be strengthening to me, because if it's a temptation to evil, it can't be a test from God. It just mm-hmm. says right out there, God does not tempt. And if it's tempting to evil, then it's not a test. Just outright wrong. Actually, I think God doesn't set you up for a test of evil.
Actually, I need to get my Greek New Testament.
While you're doing that, Gene, so if God tempts no one, there's a difference between someone allowing me to be tempted and someone tempting me, correct? I think that's what we're talking about.
Yeah. You get James 1. So James 1, 13. Parosomai is the word used there for testing. And let me finish. Okay, so the difference between testing and tempting, apparently in the Greek, if I'm not mistaken, is the difference between the middle case and the active case. I never knew that before, because I never read James in the Greek. So I'm not even familiar with this word, parazomai or paraze, parazo, I guess is what it would be in the active case. They're very closely related. And what this person has done, let me ask this, those of you who have other versions than my Common English Bible. Mine has, no one who is tested should say God is tempting me. So there's tested and there's tempting. What do you have in your versions? Do you have a different word?
Free Bible just has the word, no one should say when they're tempted, that because God does not tempt. He's not tempted by evil himself.
He doesn't see that there's any difference between the middle and the active.
In the NET version, it only uses the word tested the one time in that one verse. All the rest of the times it's tempted.
Yeah, see, that's what mine does. And I can't figure that out.
It sounds like it may be a translation interjection.
It's got to be a translation issue where they're trying to see a difference between the middle and the active mood. Or mode.
Well, it's clear that God allows us to be tempted. Yeah. He himself was tempted in every way like we are. Yeah, without Jesus, sin.
Jesus was led into the wilderness by the Holy Spirit in order to be tempted
mm-hmm.
by Satan.
I was going to say that the Lord's Prayer, which, you know, we're to pray, says, and lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil, some says, or from the evil one.
Mm-hmm.
Here's another way to look at this from the other direction. Ask this question: is would be, would God block me from being tempted by something?
Well, it says God won't allow us to be tempted over more than we can bear. That sounds like a block.
Yeah. So we would think of it as God's on our side. Okay. So if God can rightfully, with someone who is trusting themselves to him, rightfully interject a block, God would do that. I start from the easiest way I understand these things is I got to start from the premise that God, everything God does, every action God does in my behalf is done because of his perfect love. And his love is wisdom, wise. It knows what is best in all cases, all the time. God doesn't make mistakes with my life. God always acts out of love. And so if I see something where God is looks like he's tempting me, or if God is blocking a temptation, my access to a temptation or something, I always try to understand that as either I'm misreading it, or that God in his wisdom knows that is the loving thing to do in this particular situation. And that prevents me from, like religious thinking does, is let's set a rule that says God will never do this, God will always do this. You know, we want like we have 10 commandments, we like another 10 things that we always know it's this way or that way, it's this way or that way. We like to have everything nailed down. And God says, well, that might be one way to look at it, that I like to work on the level of what is right in the word, in the thought of love, in the perfect love, wisdom, end of things. That's how I act. And that's where I start from, thinking the way God might be thinking, instead of, yeah, I have some rules that I work by here, and I will never do this, I will always do that. And, you know, those are my rules, and I can't break my rules. And so that helps me sometimes to think of it that way.
I think it's interesting that my chapter has these subheadings, and the first one is called The Purpose of Tests. And then after starting with verse 13, it's called The Source of Temptations. That's the subheading, some of the subheadings in this chapter. But what one thing that came to mind for me when we were reading these particular verses is that in the ancient world, one of the primeval gods of the Greco-Roman world was Eros. And Eros is not a term for love that's used anywhere in the Bible. This is very interesting. Eros is a term that means love, but it's also the name of a Greek god. And so Eros stands for love, but the Greeks' understanding of the gods is that they're very human-like and they're capricious. Eros in particular is manipulative and sneaky, and he goes around tempting people or getting them to fall in love. You know, we have the image of the arrow in the heart. That's Eros. When you see images, little statues of Eros, we also call this Cupid. And the little angelic fat babies with wings, that's a representation adopted by the Church of Eros. And so when we talk about love and God and temptation in the Greek mind, that this God is tempting and playing with people and fate and bringing people together and making them fall in and out of love, and is quite manipulative and sneaky in this way. And I feel like James is saying, you know, what God is like. He's like, look, he's not there tempting you into this. And we understand, you know, in our picture of God, yes, we do go through tests, we do go through trials, and this develops our character, but it's different from this Greek sense of being tempted and enticed into you know, being just infatuated and but yes, it's not that Greek sense. So it could be that, you know, he's making a distinction here between the Greeks' understanding of the gods and their level of the way they tempt people, mm-hmm. and the Hebrew understanding of God, which it does mm-hmm. involve tests that develop your character and faith, but it's not capricious, mm-hmm. it's not manipulative.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm tying both of those together. I mean, I think it's so. Buzz, I think, has put his finger on the core principle for understanding what God does in the Bible and in our lives, is that it's always God always acts from the highest sense of love. And anything that's not based in that is not God. Now, one could certainly make a case that some things that look pretty nasty from our point of view might in fact be the highest expression of love, and not appear that way to us immediately. But the bottom line is still, if it's the highest expression of love, then that's what God does. And if it's not the highest expression of love, then it's not God. And I think that's all he's saying here.
Also, you would say, I think that it's foolhardy for people who are heavily tainted with selfism to judge whether that was God's love or not. It's just, you know, kind of silly.
When I look at this for me and how this speaks to me, instead of, because James is very clear, God doesn't tempt anyone. And when I try to combine 14, 15, you know, so when, temptations test, God is saying, Nancy, this is an opportunity for me to look at the evil desires in me that come up in whatever circumstances I'm facing. And at that time, I get to make a choice if I want God to heal me and if I want to reflect who he is, or if I want to act just out of my sin nature, selfishness, fear. You know, so if I can view it that way, instead of this is something God's doing to me, which James is very clear is not the case, but it's an opportunity for me to say, wow, I really need to look at my reactions here, my selfishness, my anxiety, my self-focus, whatever. At least for me, I think that's God saying, that's part of the character development, is using this opportunity to react differently. I get to make a choice about that in the freedom that he's given me.
I like that. I looked up the word. There's actually two words being used in James, and they're related. They mean virtually the same thing. Peroso, I'm not sure. I forgot already. The other one is perazo. And it means to attempt something. It means to attempt something. It means to come to bring to trial. Therefore, it could mean either tempt or test.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a lot of burden rests on the translator to decide which one it's best to translate. I tend to prefer testing or bring to trial, because I think every time we tempt ourselves, in a sense, we're putting ourselves on trial.
Mm-hmm. I don't know how this plays into it, but in this Free Bible version, it throws in the word evil. And God is not tempted by evil. And I appreciate that, because what is the end goal here? It's our evil desires that lead to sin. And what's being pointed out is that sin will kill you. And the next verse 15.
The word is kakon, which would be evil.
Yeah.
And my version has that too. God is not tempted by any form of evil.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And New International uses evil also.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's in the text.
So I think evil, there's something, again, I look in the mirror and what do I see? Maybe I'm my own worst enemy because it's my evil desires, not just healthy desires, that tempt me. And anything that's evil in my mind is sinful, and anything that's sinful is evil. So I think what is being said here is anything contrary to God's character mm-hmm. is evil or sinful.
Yeah. And once again, like Katrina said, we have the Lord's Prayer. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil, or the evil one can be either.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, why don't we go on to 16, because it gets brighter in verse 16. 16 to 18, who wants to read?
I can read again. My dear friends, don't be deceived. All that's good, every perfect gift, is from above and comes from the Father who made heaven's light. Unlike them, he doesn't change, he doesn't vary or cause shadows. He chose to give us new life through the word of truth, so that out of all his creation, we would be very special to him.
Hmm. That's an interesting translation. That's 2:18 or through 18?
Oh, that was through 18. Is that where you want me to stop?
Yeah. The more literal translation is, he chose to give us birth by his true word, and here is the result. We are like the first crop of the harvest of everything he created. So I think what Jonathan did was to encapsulate the meaning of that, abstract it.
Well, yeah, so the first fruits were very special, so
mm-hmm.
that's another way of saying the same thing.
Any other comments on this passage, 16 to 18?
Well, I think it just underlines the point that was made before, that, you know, if it comes from Father, if it comes from the Father, it doesn't have God doesn't have a dark side, is basically what this is saying, from my understanding. We don't have a schizophrenic God, which is what I used to have. I used to think that God had this dark side God loved you, but you had to look out.
He loved you sort of like we love one another. You're good to me, so I love you. You know, we forget that God loved us while we were sinners. Okay, let's move on now to verse 19.
I can do that out of the New International here. My dear brothers and sisters, take note of this. Everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry, because human anger does not produce the righteousness that God desires. Therefore, get rid of all moral filth and evil that is so prevalent, and humbly accept the word planted in you, which can save you.
I like the quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to grow angry.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. I was just thinking that in today's environment, how much different things would be if we spent more time just listening to each other rather than assuming we know what the person means or thinks or whatever, and then just automatically assuming the worst and just, you know, then spending all our life being enraged about what these other idiots are doing. And they're obviously evil people. And that if we were to just slow down, I was listening to a podcast the other day where they were talking about not exactly this, but the idea that when we're talking, that one of the key points in leadership and in discussions with people is making sure that you've really heard them. And that, you know, part of that is that once someone has said something, rather than immediately responding to it, would be to verify that you've understood what it was that they said properly. is then, you know, that if I heard you correctly, then you were saying X, Y, or Z. Is that what you were trying to say? And then, you know, moving forward, but in a much more ordered and a slower pace of conversation, rather than just immediately just winding up into some outrage over what they may or may not have actually said or meant. Not to mention the fact that there are too many people out there in positions who have a vested interest in people being upset. And so they will purposefully take the absolute, you know, take things out of context and paint it into the absolute worst possible way to try to get people upset, because they have a vested interest in us being divided. And that this I see as being a really good antidote to that whole issue.
This is a really good statement about God's character, that when he made himself known to Moses, anger is there as patience, slow to anger.
And as far as what I've noticed, at least in myself and in others, is that usually while there is such a thing as the righteous anger, that most of the time if I get angry, it's not righteous. It's just because I think that somehow I have been slighted. I didn't get something that I deserve. I didn't, you know, whatever. And that someone has taken advantage of me, or, you know, whatever. And that it's that anger is all me sourced. And so, yeah, being a little slower to get to that point by in part of just not holding myself in such high esteem, perhaps, of what I think I actually deserve, as opposed to perhaps what I actually deserve, maybe two entirely different things.
I've found that when I'm really uptight or angry over an issue, that I'm usually dead wrong.
Yeah, that can be part of the kind of fighting back of not wanting to recognize that we've actually been wrong. And it's certainly when you run out of ways to actually really support your position, then for many people, then that's the time to go on to attack and find other ways of trying to discredit the opposition without actually providing any substance for yourself. But nonetheless, yeah, and anger can certainly be part of that.
Yeah, so therefore, with humility, set aside all moral filth and the growth of wickedness, and welcome the word planted deep inside of you, the very word that is able to save you. This is one of the things I found terribly helpful in, when we are in conflict, is first of all humility, but secondly, if our eyes are on Jesus, we can ride that conflict so much more gently and lovingly, mm-hmm, than if we're just determined to prove that we're right.
Yeah, and I think that then comes back to things that we've talked about in the past, as far as, you know, the relationship between relationships and things that help or hinder the development of relationships, and how that relates to what is sin. When our primary goal is to prove that we're right, then the relationship goes out the window. Whereas if the fostering of a deeper relationship is primary, then who's right and who's wrong becomes secondary. And in some cases may become irrelevant.
Well, maybe the next few verses would help us. I'm going to go ahead and...
Okay, before we move on, one thing, though, I was wondering, where it says here that to receive with meekness the implanted word. In my version here, the word is not capitalized. I just was wondering if perhaps it should be.
It isn't in mine either. I think they're talking about the scriptures, the word. I think translators sometimes... Mm-hmm. Refuse to capitalize it, even though they could.
Okay.
So verse 22, you must be doers of the word, not only hearers who mislead themselves. Those who hear but don't do the word are like those who look at their face in the mirror. They look at themselves, walk away, and immediately forget what they were like. That's taking a look at the word and reveal, letting it reveal ourselves to ourselves, which I think we've been, I'm speaking for myself here. I think I'm very ingenious at being such a student of the word that I actually fail to let it to reveal myself to myself.
Yeah, I think this
from time to time I've talked about if you've been around people who are in recovery, it's one of the little memes that they have, which is, this is a program of action. It's not a program of belief. And I think that we, I think that is the good thing from James, is that James says, yeah, this is a program of action. You know, they follow God's way. It's not just having loving feelings. It's taking the actions of love that really mean that, yeah, I'm following in the path that Jesus took.
And I think this kind of fits with some of the discussion we had back in Hebrews when we were going through the Hall of Faith thing, and how talked about how that in each of those instances that individual's faith was linked to things that they did. That it wasn't just that they were happy to believe and sit on the couch and say, yes, I believe, but that they, that belief then turned into, it affected the course of their life, and what they did and how they interacted with people and what they, the choices that they made moving forward. That here James is saying the same thing, and he'll get a little stronger in it later, but that the idea that if this faith or the belief you have, if it doesn't actually change you and change the way that you live, then it's really not worth anything.
I think that ties in with 1 John chapter 3, for from death to life because we love the brothers and sisters.
Mm-hmm.
That's the change. Okay, so in other words, we need to study the word to really see ourselves and not just walk away from it and continue as we were.
Yeah, it reveals, as the more we study, the more we see, one, a better understanding of who God is, and then also within that, we can see how far we are from that.
But there are those who study the perfect law, the law of freedom, and continue to do it. They don't listen and then forget, but they put it into practice in their lives. They will be blessed in whatever they do. It's interesting that he refers in that context to the law of freedom, that we're supposed to look at the law of freedom and see our defects. So I'm going to tell a story on myself that I learned something about myself. My kitty, on a cold winter night, brought in a pregnant female mouse and dropped it on the floor. The mouse was not hurt at all and vanished before the cat could catch it. And I didn't know what to do, and I hated to capture the mouse and put it back outside. And my mother told me, she was still alive then, she told me, you know, it's very hard to catch mice in the house. I procrastinated. And the next thing I knew, I had a nice family of mice. Because it doesn't take very long time for them to gestate. So I didn't know what to do. I tried putting peanut butter out to see if they would eat it, and they ate one bite and then wouldn't touch it anymore. So I apparently bought the wrong kind of peanut butter. Had too many other things in it. And I tried live trapping them. They played with the live trap and shut it and left it for me to find the next morning with no mice in it. I thought about dead trapping them, but if they wouldn't eat the peanut butter, that wouldn't work. So I started really praying. And a still small voice said to me very quietly and gently, why don't you do it not by might nor by power, but by my spirit. And then he showed me that I had a window that they were constantly looking out and constantly doing their business near it, that had a broken screen, just enough of a gap that they could get out of my house. And he pointed out to me that they really were at that window because they wanted out. And if I just let them be free, I would be well. So I started leaving that window open at night when they're active and running about trying to find food. And they were very hungry by then. I took all their food away from them, like my cactus plants, my Christmas cactus, and my I can't think of the term. This head injury doesn't help my brain. Easter cactus. I took all of them out of my house because they were eating on them. And they got so hungry, they started eating their own business. So when I opened the window that first night, I think about half the brood went out. And now I'm down to about 1 mouse that I'm trying to get to go out. And I thought, isn't that like God? I thought of trapping them. I thought of killing them. I thought of this, that, and the other thing. And it comes down to just letting them out.
That's
another lesson on letting go.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really thought-provoking story, Gene.
Okay.
But there are those who study the perfect law, the law of freedom, and continue to do it. They don't listen and then forget. But they put it into practice in their lives. They will be blessed from whatever they do. And that's what led me to talk about the mice, because
okay.
I go basically.
Pick up on 26.
Okay.
Those who consider themselves religious and yet do not keep a tight rein on their tongues deceive themselves, and their religion is worthless. Religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this: to look after orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world. It kind of again underlines what you do matters.
Mm-hmm. You know, James is very much a doer of the word, so to speak. Interestingly, my version translates the word religion as a devotion. If those who claim devotion to God don't control what they say, they mislead themselves, their devotion is worthless. So you can be very much about God, but if we don't control what we say and we misrepresent God to other people or mistreat other people verbally, it's worthless.
What word did your version use there?
Devotion instead of religion.
Oh, okay. Gallagher uses religious also.
He uses religion too. Yeah, that's the usual word that's used by translators. I see devotion as a Roman Catholic word, kind of for religion. But this is supposed to be translated by all evangelicals, so I don't know. Let's see if there's more than one meaning to this word. 27. Thraiskeia. This dictionary that I have, which is a reader's dictionary, it's formalism. It's formal religion. It's not devotion, unless you think of devotion as formal. So the kind of religion is talking about is going through the motions and doing the forms and ceremonies and all of that, but saying bad things.
I was reading an article recently where the point was being made that focusing on those externals is very dangerous, because if you've got the externals down, then you don't have to worry about the internals.
Yeah, exactly. It's very self-deceiving, and at least it's self-righteousness. I have it all down. I'm doing everything right. God ought to bless me. And if he doesn't, what's wrong with him?
All this I have done from my youth upward.
Yeah.
It's interesting that in this chapter here, we have this kind of the ditch on both sides of the road. You know, the adversary doesn't care which ditch he pushes you into. If you can concentrate on feeling good about your relationship with God, but not doing anything, he's fine with that. If you concentrate on the outward to the exclusion of the inward, he's fine with that too. The adversary is only worried when we're on the road itself.
And he gets very specific, doesn't he? Here, true devotion or true religion, the kind that is pure and faultless before God the Father, is this: to care for orphans and widows in their difficulties and to keep the world from contaminating us. And that was a major thing in Paul's day and James' day. The widows who didn't have family left to take care of them, or who just didn't, their families didn't care about them. Orphans who didn't have parents. Of course, there was a lot of exposure going on in the Roman Empire. By that, I mean they took infants and put them out in public and left them there to die. And often people took them to be slaves. They would raise them and raise them to be slaves in their household. So this is very, very important.
Hard to imagine such a world, and yet I'm sure it would be hard for them to imagine the mass cruelty that we participate in today.
You probably heard about the 215 graves that they found in these schools in Canada that took children from their families and tried to deprogram or reprogram them to be white and to hate their their ethnicity and their culture. It's a horrible, horrible chapter in Canadian history. We have our own chapters.
Yeah, we had our own program of, what do they call it? Integration or something. I can't remember what they called it, but make them no longer Indians. Make them white instead.
Yeah. Okay. Why don't we close with prayer? Mark, would you like to pray?
Yes. Our gracious Heavenly Father, we are so grateful for your love and for the constant message of your love that comes throughout all the scriptures that you've given us and throughout our daily lives. You truly are our loving Father and are much more anxious to give us the good gifts of your way of life than our own fathers are to give us good gifts. So we thank you for the fellowship of those of like mind who are also seeking your way. We ask your blessing on all of those who hear this as well, and ask for your grace for the rest of this Sabbath and for the coming week. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.
Yeah.